Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, insert random sponsor here, is proud to bring to you its international podcasting champions of the world, Precious Pat Henson, Big Sexy Scott Morris, the main event, Meeple!
Okay, we are going to do this tonight, and it's going to be fun, and we are going to have a good time.
All right, welcome everybody. It is our first episode post-Full Gear. Oh my goodness, how happy are you, Patrick? So spoiler alert, I mean, if you haven't watched Full Gear yet, you're probably not really a big wrestling fan.
Like, we're recording this a week after it happened.
So. It is, yeah. It's actually the 19th of November right now, right ahead of the Thanksgiving holidays. But man, what a show.
Yeah, it was really good. The thing is, and I've made this point a bunch in my blog, how spoiled I personally am at this point. The number of times Dynamite has opened and the match has just been bonkers. You know, I mean, how many times have you just watched the opening of Dynamite and had your face blown off by how good
it was? From the very first one back in October of 2019 with Sammy and Cody, they've kind of set a standard of we're going to open with one of the best matches of the night.
Yeah. Well, it's the old WCW trick. I mean, they would always. You know, Bischoff thought many things about the cruiserweights, but he'd always put them out there first, you know, and they always tore the house down because they knew that was people were going to remember it. I know sitting and watching with you and Goat Boy watching like this nothing cruiserweight tag match that was like Malenko, Jericho, Benoit and Eddie were all in the ring together in a tag match or something. And it was just nuts. And that was like, yeah, whatever, we don't care. The rest of the pay-per-view is NWO did stuff. I don't even remember. And those might not have been the four guys, but it just WCW did that all the time. They made sure to have a hot opener. And it's one of the lessons Khan has taken. They do it with Rampage almost exclusively, where essentially the show is in reverse.
Reverse order, right.
Yeah, where the main event is the first thing, because they know that they're going to lose viewers as the show goes on,
right,
because of the time slot. And so they got to get the hot match that's important to a storyline in first, and by the end of the show it feels like a house show,
you know? Yeah, it does a little bit.
It's they're not bad. That's not a bad thing, because the way AEW does it is they want their crowd to have fun, you know. They want those things to happen. They want people who are from there to win.
It's an experience.
I don't understand that. I don't understand, but WB. Anyway.
I did think they kind of tipped their hat a little bit when they said that the first Dynamite after Full Gear was going to be at Norfolk, Virginia. And I'm like, well, it's not Aaron's Creek, but it's right down the road.
It's right down the road. Like the friggin' pay-per-view is named after him.
Yeah.
About a joke leading in where they made fun of the fact that he wasn't as ripped as Pac, which is like saying, you know, the sun also came up. Nobody's as ripped as Pac is, especially then. But he was so good. That match was excellent. They structured it really, really well. And we're so spoiled by All Out being the previous pay-per-view. And by everything but Sparkler Gate at the end of Revolution. Revolution was really good.
Yeah.
The last year's pay-per-views were pretty good. AEW puts on a hell of a show. And when they go nuts and they go all out, it's good stuff. And, you know, in the past 6 months, we've had the All Out pay-per-view. We've had the Arthur Ashe event. We've had CM Punk,
which essentially was a pay-per-view.
Yeah, I mean, it was
live on TV over two nights, right?
Yeah, it was like, here's a free TV show.
And they've talked a little bit about the Battle of the Belts, which is either potentially a 1 hour or maybe 2 hour special that'll be live on TV in January, which I think will actually, that will be the one where they probably crown the TBS championship for the women's. I think that would make sense.
They've said that actually they're going to crown the finals for the tournament are going to be on the TBS premiere of Dynamite.
Okay, that makes sense too. I was going to say that's the other only really other option for that I think, which I still think right now, I think that that is Jade's belt to lose.
I agree.
I think that she's got the most momentum out of anybody. I think her and Thunder Rosa in the finals would make perfect sense. I think Thunder Rosa losing and moving on to Britt Baker finally would make perfect sense. All that stuff. But that is something we're going to talk about later in this show, because that is a topic of mine that we're going to chat about.
It was one of my many, hey, we should talk about this topics, but I kept it. But in general, Full Gear was really good. You had the CM Punk Eddie Kingston match is as close as I'll get to perfection in a like 12-minute match.
It was the first match in a long time. I mean, and this is not taking anything away from what AEW has done, because like you said, All Out was an amazing pay-per-view. And in ways, I feel bad for Full Gear, because I feel like it didn't get as much praise as it should, because we're still hung over from that big event 3 years ago or 3 months ago. I do think that them having pay-per-views every 3 months is a big reason why their pay-per-views are so good, because it's not just constant churning on everything. But that Eddie Kingston moment when he backhanded him before the bell and he went down,
it was so good.
Literally had me jump out of my seat. And Eddie's reaction with the whole laughing and everything. And yeah, the flash went through my head of, wait a minute, if he pins him right here and it's like over in like 10 seconds, that is going to send shockwaves through the wrestling industry, right?
I mean, well, then because then you couldn't get it to, like, they couldn't have done that. And if they did, they have bigger balls than I do, because then it becomes, well, you lost in 8 seconds in MMA.
Right, right.
You know, and they do that bit, you know, that would have been...
I said when Punk came back, I I knew that Punk's plan was to fight up and coming kids. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I actually think the money in that story would have been better had Punk continuously lost. If Punk and Rob from our group has talked about this a couple of times, if he lost from the get-go to every single person and it became this question of, do I still have it? Can I still go? I can obviously still go in the ring and I got the cardio and I'm ready to rock, but I can't win, right? Yeah. So what would it take for me to win? I mean, right now, I think there's two major stories happening. The first one is obviously Daniel Bryanson or Daniel Bryanson. I can't get this guy's name for the love of Pete. I did kind of like how at the pay-per-view they made fun of that and they kept specifically saying over and over again, Bryan Danielson, Bryan Danielson, Bryan Danielson. Like, they wouldn't call him just Danielson or just Bryan or anything. So that talks about our programming in our heads. But that's a whole other thing.
When I'm writing it, I have to pick one. And it's usually Danielson, because it's
I'm gonna just call him Bryan. That's it.
I've tried that. And it's what's weird is when I'm like, and this is inside baseball, but when I'm like writing, I hate the idea of calling one guy by his last name and the other guy by his first name.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it's sure. Consistency, it matters. But I think that him versus Hangman is obviously, especially with the opening of Dynamite and how they handled it, that's story number one. You have not seen the rest of Dynamite from Wednesday, though, so you do not know what has happened with CM Punk.
No, I don't.
So I won't spoil it, but I will just simply say that what is happening with CM Punk right now is probably the second biggest storyline in AEW. So you're gonna love it because it caught me by surprise completely. And when
the fact that Len gave it an A+, another guy in our group, Facebook group, we have this. So for those, I'm gonna wax on this for a second. A Facebook group. Who some of them are listening to this, because it's
Like, I hope they're all listening to
it. Yeah, I do too. We'd have more listeners if everybody in those two groups were listening to it. It is one of the most positive environments I've ever been in, where I go to Facebook to have a good time and talk about wrestling. We talk about comic books. There's some gaming in there, and it's legit. Like, disagreements happen, but there's a lot of good. Yeah, I don't agree with you, but here's my point. And okay, I see where you see what you said, and it's.
It's this crazy place on the internet where adults exist and operate. Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. And none of us really, apart from maybe 2 degrees of separation, like, you didn't know a lot of the guys in the group when you came in. I didn't know a lot of the guys. I knew Rob, and that, I think that was it. So it's like, there's a lot of these guys we haven't even met in person. So
yeah, I know you and two people that I've invited.
There you go.
And
we're living proof, though, that you can actually be on the internet and not disrespect each other's opinions.
and our hope is that one day those guys will want to join us on this podcast and talk about the same stuff we talk about, because Rob and I disagree basically constantly. But because we do it in a respectful, giving shit kind of way, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, like, for sure.
And I think we've had in the 2 or 3 years I've been, I don't know, it's the whole time I've been on that group, I think we've had 2 incidents of wait a minute, we need to tell this guy to be quiet.
We've handled it, and everyone's been respectful. So
yeah, it's been
great. So that's, when you hear us talk about the Facebook group, that's what we're talking about. So yeah,
and they're fantastic. And they're all everybody who speaks up usually is really smart about what they're talking about. And
except for Rob. Yeah.
Except for Rob. Yeah. Rob's just wrong, like, all the time. You know, I mean, he did walk up to Leafield with that comic book. I mean,
I think that's true. Yeah.
All right. If I wrote that comic, I would have.
Well, but let's, and if you are listening to this and you're wondering, there is a great comic book that our friend Rob actually writes and helps with, and it's called Junior High Horrors. And yes, it's really cool. Check it out. You would not be disappointed at all.
Yeah. Also, if you suffer with dyslexia, he's really big on creating comic books that are designed to help with that.
Yep. He uses a dyslexia friendly font, and it's very, very, very cool. So, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's jump into our opener. We've talked about how happy we are with Full Gear. Let's get into some of the questions that we like to ask each other to learn more about ourselves, and our listeners can learn about us. So you want to start this week? You want to ask me, or me to ask you?
So what wrestler most shaped the way you watch wrestling today, and why?
When you say the way I watch wrestling, do you mean how I perceive it, or like has motivated me for things, or
like, so for me, it's Macho Man, Randy Savage.
Ooh, yeah. Gotcha for 3 minutes. Yeah.
No, I used to be able to do a Macho Man. I can't anymore for some reason. The reason
he's rises to the top. The cream of the crop.
Anyway, my Macho Man is terrible.
I can tell.
Yeah, it's so bad. I don't know what happened. But
not as good as your Dieter.
No, but did that actually make it to tape? Anyway,
no.
But anyway, he was so obsessed with the detail of the match.
Mm-hmm.
And like the legend is that he and Steamboat had that WrestleMania 3 match plotted down to the second.
Yep.
And they rehearsed it to the second, and they knew exactly what was going on. The story that Jake the Snake tells about him on Dark Side of the Ring, you know, like making sure that he got bit by the snake to make sure that he knew that the snake was cool and stuff. He was so obsessed with the details. And in a way, watching how much fun I had watching him, I started looking at all the little things people did. Mm-hmm. And that's how I watch wrestling now, is looking for, like, you know, Christian doing the veteran thing where he shoves somebody's head to the side when he's pinning him.
Sure.
You know, it's this tiny thing, but it tells you I'm a veteran. I know what I'm doing.
So that's actually probably two people for me. One being modern, one being old. The first one is someone you might not expect, which is Seth Rollins. And the reason I would say Seth Rollins is not for the reasons that most people would think. Most people would think Seth Rollins as, you know, one of the biggest stars in WWE and, you know, very popular, member of the Shield, all those things. I remember when people were looking at Seth and basically pointing fingers saying, this guy injures people, right? He injured Finn Balor. He injured Sting. And
yeah.
I remember watching those matches back and looking at them because I'm a huge Sting mark. I love Sting. And I don't believe that he injured those people. I think they did get injured during the match. I don't think it was by negligence by either party. It was just part of the match and how things were going. But I think that what happened is most people got on their horse of, you took away Sting and I don't like you because of that. And then therefore it started to perpetuate itself and perpetuate itself and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, the main reason that Seth Rollins has helped me shape how I look at wrestling today was because he was a main instigator in the infamous Hell in a Cell match between him and The Fiend. And that match was the match that broke my straw on my camel's back, or broke the back of, I don't want to watch this garbage anymore. And that really led me down the pathway of, while I grew up on WWE and I love WWE, I grew up on WWF and love WWF, I don't like WWE, that there's a clear distinction between those two things. He helped shape me watching modern wrestling in terms of finding alternative sources to WWE programming. But the person that really kind of woke me up as a kid to wrestling is an art, and wrestling is artists performing in the ring and doing amazing things in the ring, it would be Billingham. It would be Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid, when I was young, I remember looking at this guy and he didn't look like a superstar. I mean, he was built. I mean, the guy was, I mean, you talk about Pac ripped. Like, this guy was ripped at a time when guys were not ripped that were his size, right? The guys that had the muscles were the big 6'8" Hulk Hogans. They were not the 5'11" Dynamite Kids. And I always remember that the name made me feel kind of like they're trying to, like, say he's not as good because he's a kid and not an adult or something. But watching his matches, watching the match that we talked about previously on the Wrestling Classic with him and Randy Savage, watching him and Davey Boy Smith against Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake, the guy was so technically pure in the ring. And you could tell he would get visibly upset when things didn't work correctly. And it was a very different experience to watch him wrestle than watch other people wrestle. And I firmly believe that he helped impact Bret Hart, and he helped shape and mold Bret Hart into what we got from Bret Hart, which I think is awesome.
Not only Bret Hart, Bryan Danielson talks about him.
Yeah, for sure.
Punk has talked about him. Jericho talks about him as a huge influence.
Yeah. He changed the way a lot of people look at it, I think. So,
yeah.
No, so I have,
he's awesome.
You have a wrestling question for me. I have a gaming question for you.
All right.
And this is one that was actually asked of me recently, and I wanted to ask it to you, and I think it's kind of cool. If you could play a game with any one person, alive or past, who would it be? What would you play and why?
Honestly, I'd love to play a game of Warhammer 40K with Robin Williams.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a crazy combination.
Well, he was a big Warhammer 40K player. Like, he had Neldar army. Yeah, he had Neldar army and everything. He was
did not know that.
Yeah, he's very into it. He was a giant gamer. Like, his daughter is named after Zelda.
I knew that.
It's either Zelda or she her name is a video game record. But no, he was a Warhammer 40K guy. And I think that would be an amazing amount of fun to see what he brought to the table and just to bask in him having a good time.
That's beautiful, man. I loved him as a human being. And I thought that his story that came out much after he passed away was so tragically sad. And, you know, they always say that, you know, comedy comes from a place of tragedy. And the man was ridiculously funny. I mean,
yeah,
always funny.
Well, he's the, to me, he is the cautionary tale. When you see somebody in your life who is always on and always having a good time and never seems to have a bad day, you need to check maybe on that person, because people who are neurodivergent, you know, and as one, I can say this, you know, it's, I have ADD and have talked about it a little bit, but you mask what's really going through your head and it's hard to deal with. And so Williams was masking so much pain.
Yeah.
All the time. And it led to absolutely gut-wrenchingly fun things to watch. If you go on YouTube and just go watch him with Craig Ferguson.
Yeah.
Late night. Like, oh my God, it's so much fun.
Who's another person? Absolutely so much fun. I like Ferguson.
Yeah, yeah. Ferguson's great. Yeah, Williams playing a game of 40K with Robin Williams would be really fun.
Now that you've educated me that he was into that, now I want to go do more research on him and figure out more things, because I, in a bajillion times of seeing things on him, never heard that before, and I think that's cool.
Ansel Elgort, Baby Driver.
Yeah,
40K player.
Really?
Yeah, he actually does an interview on Conan where he talks about it, and Conan asks him, like, so you paint toys? And he's like, yeah, they're little, you know, like, he talks about painting the miniatures.
They're action figures.
No, they're not. They're miniatures.
We
call them toy soldiers because the normies at conventions, the normies who are staying in the hotel with us at the conventions don't want a long explanation. So we're playing with toy soldiers is like the easy way to say it. Also, it takes the piss out of your ego to say that. Robin Williams 40K. That'd be a lot of fun.
Very cool.
Today, Pat continues to educate his mother on wrestling. And Scott is deeply unsettled. All right. So we've already talked about professional wrestling, Mark, Smark, Spot, Pop, Heat, Cheap Heat, X-Pac Heat, Wrestler, Face, Heel, Tweener, Referee, Commentary, Ring Announcer. We haven't talked about one of the more important words that means nothing but means everything in professional wrestling as kayfabe.
Kayfabe.
Kayfabe. Or so. I used to think it was like a French word that came from the Canadians. It's not. It is a word that exists only in professional wrestling. It doesn't actually mean anything.
It's a sniglet.
It's a sniglet. It's another word. What it means is the illusion of truth, essentially.
This is actually real. A political term, is what it is. Da-dum-ching.
No, it is the veil of secrecy that not all of this is real. All of this, nobody's pulling a punch ever. These are absolutely legit fights.
I am Hulk Hogan. I'm only going to have dinner with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, not the Iron Sheik.
like when Iron Sheik and Jim Duggan back in the day got pulled over and they had a ton of drugs in their car, the reaction that the wrestling guys had was not, you got busted with drugs, what the hell? It was,
you got busted with each other.
Why are you in the car with Iron Sheik, Jim?
Yep.
It's excellent. But the idea is that, you know, it's still real to me, damn it. The idea that, you know, you don't break the veil of wrestling. And there's tons and tons of stories about it. You know, that Jim Stossel got knocked down a couple times over it. But really, it's a long-term tradition in wrestling that you don't talk about what's going on in the back. That was, of course, destroyed in the late 90s by Vince himself when he threw out a two things. One, he threw out a promo that was like, we think you have more intelligence, blah, blah, blah. But also he broke it himself when he went in front of the New Jersey Sports Authority and went, no, it's all predetermined. And
killing the business.
And now nowadays, everybody acknowledges that they don't, the name they wrestle under is rarely their actual name. That's why in the first episode, we were so surprised that Wardlow's actual last name is Wardlow.
Mm-hmm.
They are portraying a character, and the moves they do are designed to be almost a dance with each other. When we say somebody's working stiff, that means they're hitting a little too hard. You know, in the last pay-per-view, Rey Fénix was criticized for perhaps being a little stiff with one of the FTR guys and knocking him cold. And so the whole idea with kayfabe is it's a secret society kind of thing, and you don't want to let anybody else in.
Right.
Now, with that, there's another term that goes with kayfabe that's important, and that is the booker. The booker is essentially the head writer. If this was a TV show, they'd be called the showrunner. They're the person who basically lays out what's going to happen in any match. They determine who wins and loses. They determine the long-term storylines, and they determine what's going to happen within every match. Sometimes down to you're going to do this spot or that spot to either protect a move, to cancel a move out, or to do other things like that. On top of that, they are usually the final voice in the room as far as any discussion or argument of, well, what are we going to do? Who's going to win? Who's going to lose? And they determine who does the job. Does the job is a wrestling term of you lay down and you eat the pin. You're going to get pinned for this, and it's the booker who decides what's going to happen. In modern wrestling, that comes down to two guys. In WWE, Vince McMahon has the final say on everything and has for decades. In AEW, it's Tony Khan. And in Tony Khan, we trust. All hail Tony Khan. We love him. He is our savior. If you disagree, I'll fight you. I won't, but, you know, whatever. He's a modern booker.
If you disagree, I will be sorely disappointed.
I will look down upon my nose at you. Now, he's made his mistakes, and he's done some dumb stuff, and we'll talk about that here in a minute when we talk about the women's division. But
yeah.
I would rather watch his storytelling than Vince McMahon's. And he has,
any day of the week.
And he is
twice on Sundays.
He's done a good job. Paul Heyman, when he was in ECW, he was the head booker and does a great job. Paul Heyman's booking strategy was to figure out what people did well and then make them do that. And figure out what they didn't do well and don't make them do that.
Yep.
Shocking.
Lean into what they're good at.
Yeah.
Any good leader does that.
Yeah. It's like, hey, we're not going to put you in positions to fail.
So I'm curious about the next three terms that you have listed here, because my question is, are these different?
Authority figures, factions, teams, and stables?
I skipped authority. Let's talk about authority. Yeah, authority.
So authority figures
because authority used to not be a thing.
It used to not be a thing. It was like an off-screen character like
Jack Tunney, the president of WWE, who was elected or did anything really.
Yeah, or the network, you know, right. for a couple of
the
things.
Executives.
And then Vince McMahon screws Bret Hart and essentially outs himself as the sole owner of WWE, then at WWF, and becomes the central figure in the feud with Stone Cold Steve Austin. And as such, he's the president of the company and the lead guy, and he is the villain because he's the boss and becomes the authority figure who is essentially the dictator and tells everybody what they can and can't do. And it's sort of a wink and a nod that everybody knows who he is. They know that he ultimately holds the power and does the story, and the people who talk back to him, weirdly, in Vince's case, if you sneeze around him, it's bad for you. No, really, like if you sneeze around Vince McMahon,
I know the story.
You might get fired.
Yeah,
it's bizarre. Like it's very weird. He has a bunch of weird habits, but he became the authority figure. Unfortunately,
and since that, there has been a continuous stream of authority figures. Right, there's been the Raw anonymous GM. There's been Eric Bischoff. There's been and I would say, while I personally prefer Eric Bischoff's authority figure and the role he played on TV versus Vince McMahon, I think you were right in what you said a couple of weeks ago, is that Vince McMahon's Mr. McMahon is the quintessential heel, because he's the guy that everyone can relate to. I mean, so many people in the world don't like their boss that it just, it's relatable character, right?
Mm-hmm. And you want to, like, secretly you want to punch him in the face, and
I remember hearing an interview with Stone Cold once where he said that that was the best thing, is that he got to make a career out of punching his boss in the face, right? Yeah. Which is what most people would dream of. So,
or kicking him in the stomach.
So now my question for you now is these next three terms: factions, teams, and stables.
Well, the thing is, when you talk about wrestling and you talk about a group of more than one guy, more than one team, first of all, you can have a tag team, which is traditionally two people. And usually those matches are a tag team match where two men fight two men, or two women fight two women. Sometimes you have mixed gender tag teams where it's man and a woman fight a man and a woman. And there are specific rules around that and what they can and can't do. They're usually a team of two people. Then there are factions and stables, and depending on where you are, factions and stables mean the same thing. They can be, a faction can be a group of people who all have the same idea and are under the same leadership. They can also, you know.
Would you consider the NWO a faction or a stable? I would consider them a faction.
Yeah,
and I would consider the NWO Black and White a stable, and the NWO Wolfpack a stable.
Yeah, I would agree. So. And traditionally, a stable is like, a stable is centered around like one guy who is super over.
Ric Flair.
And kind of the leader. Yeah, Ric Flair in the arguably the best stable of all time, the Four Horsemen.
No, not arguably.
Usually.
I mean, you can argue, you're wrong, but you can argue.
you usually have a young star who's on the up and on the come and is going to be the next big thing. And usually one of the jobs of a stable is to build him up to be the next big thing so that he can get over and sometimes dethrone the big guy. The evolution in WWE, for all of the one-man power trip in Triple H's to his fault, they accomplished something very real in that Batista and Randy Orton got over as viable threats and legitimate big dudes, big threats. Sometimes you'll have like a manager or a older guy who's there to make sure that, you know, they're there to tutelage or to be tutelage for the younger guys. Again, evolution, which is kind of the epitome to me of how to do a stable right. How to do a stable right, and Ric Flair was your mentor kind of character in that group. The NWO is a faction where you have just a small army of people. In AEW, because that's where we find ourselves and love what's going on, everybody has friends. Everybody has a faction. They got a team.
Some of them have best friends.
Best friends are a really good example of a stable.
Yes.
Who have, you know, their big star in Orange Cassidy. You've got your tag team in the best friends in Chuck and Trent. And you have an excellent women's wrestler in Chris Statlander. And then you have a young star on the up and up, which is... I forgot.
Wheeler Yuta.
Wheeler Yuta.
Don't also understand that pairing, but we'll leave that for another time.
Because he's buddies with those guys. And also he's game for anything, really.
I feel as though Wheeler is more about the nepotism in AEW than most other people.
Really?
Yep.
Do tell.
I think he came out of nowhere, and the thought of putting so much effort into Cody Rhodes and his nightmare family, which I would consider a faction.
Yeah, I would agree.
I think making such a big deal about Cody being the one training people, why is Orange Cassidy training people? Like, Orange shouldn't care two bits about training anybody. He should be like if I went up to Orange Cassidy and said, I want you to train me, he would be like, okay, cool. Right? You know, like,
Orange
you
Cassidy, can watch. If you watch the BTE episodes, Orange Cassidy isn't the one doing the training. It's all the Kentucky gentleman.
Chuck Taylor. Yeah.
Chuck Taylor doing
But I do think that from what I understand, it is Cassidy that's kind of the mentor for him. So.
And they're buddies. The impression that I get is they were friends on the independent scene. And right about the time Wheeler Yuta got signed, Daniel Garcia also showed up and got signed. And they're both, they apparently put on in whatever indie fed they were in. I think it was in, I don't know the name of it. Forgive me for being bad. The two of them had a baller match.
Yeah, I think you're really going to like the, I'll just call it the segment on Dynamite with Daniel Garcia. Because someone calls him out on something that I think is really good. So
I think Daniel Garcia reminds me of like what happens if you take the aggression that oozed out of a young Chris Benoit before he went crazy and put it with the raw technician that was Dean Malenko.
Ooh, that's a good comparison. That's a very good comparison.
I think that he can, I think he will be a star. I think he'll be a great heel. He needs to change his socks. They look goofy. I don't get that look, but it's memorable because it's unique.
You know who he reminds me of, which I pointed this out to a friend of mine and he thought I was kind of weird for it. He kind of reminds me of Bob Backlund.
He does in the ring in terms of what he can do.
Yeah.
Outside of the ring, not at all, but inside the ring, I fully believe that Daniel Garcia can break every bone in your body and with enough moves. And he is a hell of a technician, just like Backlund was.
What would you consider him in 2.0? Faction, stable, or team?
Team.
Yep, that's what I was going to say. So I think that we're on the same definitions there. Yeah.
They're just some guys who have common interests. And are hanging out together.
The enemy of my enemy.
Yeah. Well, I think more so they jokingly refer to Daniel Garcia as their son.
Yes, they do.
2.0 are wonderful in their perfect willingness to be just the biggest bastards in any room.
Yeah.
And if you want to know just how much heat they're going after, they have decided to be the ones who are taking on Aubrey Edwards.
Yep.
Yep. They were picking a fight with Aubrey. Yep. And my wife heard that happening as I was watching BTE. And she did the motion with her neck, like evil look of like, what? You know, so they.
One could almost say that's unsettling.
Oh, yeah. It is unsettling. So tell us, Scott, why are you unsettled?
Thankfully, I'm not unsettled. No, the thing that I had written down here, Pat and I do notes ahead of all of our shows, and I wrote down the word unsettled. For the board gamers in the world, go Google unsettled. It is a Kickstarter that I just received a little while back, maybe about a month and a week ago. And it was a game that I was very excited about when I saw it, because as I've talked about on some other segments in the show, I really like narrative, story-driven games. I like things that are really big adventure-type games. And this looked to scratch that itch, but I didn't realize how good of a product it would be, as apart from just being a game. When I received it, the box is very different. Most board game boxes are square. Most board game boxes are designed to be the size they are because of the boards in them or the components in them or whatever it may be. And Unsettled is this box that looks like an Xbox Series X box. It is big and rectangular, odd shaped, and you're like, the heck is this? Like, what's going on here? And when you open the box for the first time, if you could imagine a box that, let's say, is about 7 to 8 inches high off the table. Like, that's how thick it is. Okay.
Wow. That's like
it's taller than Gloomhaven, actually, but it's very thin. It's my not goodness. Boxy. It's rectangular, right? So imagine a rectangular thing, really rectangular thing. When you lift it up, the sides of the bottom of the box have a giant U cut out of them. So that number one, lifting off the box top and putting on the box top is super smooth because the airflow is great.
Nice.
But all these trays in the game that manage anomalies and different things that you're going to be discovering in the game that all you have to do is like reach your hands in and pick them up and pull them out, and they're all set up and it's ready to go. The storage they did for the game is absolutely phenomenal.
And it's all built into the box.
Yeah, it was really, really, really well done from an experience perspective. But the thing that really amazed me about the game is the exploration piece of the mechanics of the game are so well done. You have these little small boxes that ironically will fit inside of the big box. Then each box is a planet. And each planet has three different stories on it. But you can take the game, and this is the best part that I love about this. Most people would think about that and go, okay, so each planet has three chances to play it, and then you're done with it. Wrong. Because each setup for the planet is different. So I may play the first story for the first planet and lay out cards in a specific way. And the very next time I play it, those cards will be laid out in a different way, in a different combination of things. So that's one layer to it. And somebody could easily look at that and say, okay, we're done. That's the variability. We're good. But these guys took it to a whole nother level because on the cards that you are going to be exploring that represent the spaces on the planet that you're on, you can search for opportunities. And the opportunities will then become paired with an anomaly. And the anomaly will then give you an ability in the game. So as an example, and I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but in the first game, there's the spore clouds that have a very big impact to the planet that you've landed on. Because the whole idea of the game is that we are, and I love this part of it, we are not astronauts. We are not Duke Daring, like space ace, run around astronauts. We're engineers and we're scientists. And we have landed on a planet and we are the only ones left of our crew. And we have to discover the planet's secrets to help us survive and achieve different things. And
so the Martian.
Very much so, very much like the Martian, not Marvin. but the thing that was really cool about it is we played a game and we got an anomaly that did something positive and interacted with these spore clouds. We then decided to put the system to the test and play the exact same game with the exact same layout of cards. We didn't change the layout of the cards, but we just wanted to see what the anomaly and opportunity system would bring us. The very first thing we got was the very same anomaly that helped us against the spore clouds in the first game, and now was completely negative and impacted things badly.
Oh, wow.
So there's these multiple layers of variability in the game. And I know that there's a big argument that you could make around does variability provide replayability? And there's arguments pro and con against that. But I really, really like the way that they have layered the variability to be the discovery mechanic of the game. And it's just a superbly done product. It's by a company called Orange Nebula. I would highly recommend to check them out. I've backed three different Kickstarters from them. Never been disappointed once by them. They are really, really good products. Really, really good games. But this one is by far, I think, their piece de resistance.
Nice. Nice. One of the things that a classic game, it's 15. God, it's almost 20 years old now. The original Arkham Horror was frustrating because once you figured it out, there wasn't a lot of variability to it. And so the idea that they've taken the same pieces and how they interact with one another makes a different game every time you play it. Sounds fantastic. That sounds really good. And also just that box description makes me really
Google it. It's a great, it looks great. Yeah. There's some unboxing videos that people have on YouTube right now that are really, really good too. And
is it retail ready?
I think it's available through their website right now. I think that's the only way you can get it. So
on the mid card today, Pat rants about buying a house in Final Fantasy. But first, Scott will talk about the women's division in AEW and just What the hell are they doing?
Yeah, so I titled my topic, Why Can't AEW Get It Right? And it's painful. I don't know this for fact. I believe it's fact, but I don't know this for fact, that Kenny Omega had a big hand in the booking of the women's division when things started. And for anyone that's not familiar, Riho was the very first champion, who was a tag team partner in intergender matches with Kenny in New Japan, and a big, like, nepotistic connection to Kenny, I would say. the finals of the very first women's division was her versus Nyla Rose. And Nyla is a polarizing figure to many people in the sport. And I won't get into that. I will just say that I think that Nyla is a breath of fresh air in the sport. And I'll leave it at that.
One thing that's important to note when you talk about Nyla versus Riho, Riho weighs about as much as my foot.
Or Nyla's foot.
Or Nyla's foot, really. Yeah. And Nyla is a beast.
Yes, she's that's huge. That's her whole character, is the native beast, right?
Yeah,
she's a monster. So I felt back then they made a mistake putting the belt on Riho. And we went to the Austin show where Nyla Rose won the championship. And at a time when Riho was really booked to be the babyface and the clean babyface, and Nyla was clearly booked to be the bad person in this match, people went nuts for her winning that title. They were very happy because it was very much a you deserve it and you should have been the first world champion to begin with at the beginning of this. Shida obviously did a tremendous job during the pandemic, and I think to this day is the person that they should have put the belt on first. After watching her matches while Riho and Nyla were going at it for the title, I remember looking at my wife saying, this is the woman that they should have built it around. And obviously hindsight is 2020, and it's very easy to say that.
Yeah.
But even now, fast forward to where we are now, we have clearly the best version of Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, that we have. Clearly the best. And it's very clear that this woman puts her work in. She is phenomenal. Like, I would challenge that at the height of the women's revolution in WWE with Bayley and Sasha and Becky and Charlotte, I would put Britt Baker at that level with any one of those women, because she is just killing it and crushing it in her character, in her everyday life, in her Twitter, and everything she does. She's phenomenal. I would put Britt Baker at that level with any one of those women, because she is just killing it and crushing it in her character, in her everyday life, in her Twitter, and everything she does. She's phenomenal.
She had the best cheap heat moment I've ever seen.
Ever. Which was?
The Whataburger. Your fat Whataburger.
Yeah, you and your fat Whataburger fans in Austin, Texas. Yes, that was really good. That was really good.
She picked a fight with Whataburger, which is
Don't do that in Austin, Texas.
You don't do that in Texas.
Which actually, they just opened the very first Whataburger here in Kansas City, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Patrick Mahomes owned part of a holding company that's doing that. So
that's awesome. That's awesome.
You would think with all this talent they would get it right. And they can't. Yeah. And here's the thing.
It's frustrating.
When it is. When you only book one women's match on main TV, you send a signal to the viewers that it does not matter. It's just a clear signal of, we are not worried about it, therefore you should not be worried about it. Which is extremely disappointing, because as Tay Conte and Britt showed at the pay-per-view at Full Gear, there are ways to have very good wrestling matches without having a major big blow-up feud. You can have two people go against each other in a mediocre feud that results in a very good match. And they have a lot of talent. Chris Statlander is very, very good in the ring. Thunder Rosa is phenomenal in the ring.
Yes.
Jade has made a case to arguably be one of the best rookies ever to walk into wrestling on the male or female side. Wow. She's just been amazing.
And every single match you watch
her, she is better.
You can see her get better.
Yes, and I think the pairing of her and Mark Sterling is phenomenal together.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I said this before, I think that the TBS championship is Jade's to lose. I think
I agree.
That belt is made for her right now. But even with all that, they're making so many mistakes. And ironically, I could come on here and I could argue about, you know, oh, they only book one match, or they don't give the women enough time, or they haven't booked things right. All those things are...
And all those things are true.
All those things are very true. I think the problem is that they have not created a feud. They've had these micro feuds. They've had these Shida versus Nyla, or Nyla versus Riho, or Britt versus Shida feuds, but they have not created a feud past something that they walked away from. And this is where I think that they made the mistake. Britt Baker versus Thunder Rosa is, in my opinion, the best feud that the AEW booking team has done for the women's division. And the minute that that lights out match ended, everyone forgot about that feud. It just went to the wayside and everything was gone. Britt was going on to her championship run. Thunder Rosa took time away from everything. And it was...
It didn't help that Thunder Rosa at the time was signed to a different company.
No, but that doesn't. That doesn't limit with AEW. That doesn't necessarily limit you as much as it would with like a WWE, for example.
Well, they weren't 100% sure that they were going to get her
right
for a long term contract, and so until that was inked, they didn't want to push her in. Also, they're doing a long term story with Rosa and Britt.
And I'm hoping that that's the case, because I really think that that's what they're missing. Because if you think about it, we talked about this with the good guy, bad guy, you know, kind of thing with Batman and Joker and stuff like that.
Yeah.
A good face has a good nemesis. A good heel has a good thorn in their side with a face always being there. Britt doesn't have that yet. While Shida is phenomenal, while Riho is very good, while Nyla is very good, there is no one that is Britt's nemesis. Thunder Rosa should be that person, and I'm hoping that that's what they build to. But here's my argument. Even if that does happen, even if Thunder Rosa becomes the next AEW Women's Champion, what else is there? The next closest feud I could think of is really only if you watch Roads to the Top and you think that there's heat between Jade and Red Velvet. And even if that's the case, Velvet's not past her green stage, in my opinion. No. I think she's still very good and she has a lot of opportunity, but she's not quite there yet. And when you look at the rest of that card, Statlander's great. She has never been given a feud. She hasn't been given an opportunity to be in a big time match for a long period of time, or a program. I shouldn't say match, I should say program, with somebody else to develop that. That's the thing that made the women's revolution so special inside WWE. Is you had four women all at the top of their game, elevating everyone else in that division to also compete at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. And you had all four of them cement themselves in a way that you knew this, like Bayley and Sasha were always going to be either best friends or at each other's throats. And the same thing with Becky and Charlotte. And they were either always going to be best friends or at each other's throats. That is completely missing. And I'm not saying by any means that AEW needs to copy WWE in that sense and do the exact same thing. But I think at the fundamental core of wrestling, it's good when you have a chaser and a chasee. And that doesn't exist in the AEW women's division right now.
Yeah. What they need to elevate Rosa again. Because going to live shows, and you saw this in Kansas City, I for sure saw it in Austin, and I thought it was a Texas
thing.
She's
over.
Thunder Rosa is over is all get out. And she needs to be treated.
And I still think that they need to just pay the money and get ACDC's Thunderstruck to be put on that that loudspeaker. If that started off with, you know, thunder, like that would be an amazing entrance
for her. That'd be great. She's awesome. I've not seen a match with her that I didn't enjoy.
Yeah, she's great worker. Great work.
And she's fantastic.
And apparently her son looks exactly like Sammy Guevara, which is kind of funny. So,
that's interesting. I think that Statlander versus Hayter could be a fun
feud.
That
could be really good, yeah.
Because they're two
very similar,
you know, 6 foot tall,
yeah,
big hoss kind of women.
Yeah.
And that's your like that's something you don't see in women's wrestling, is a hoss fight.
Sure.
Very often. Because they're so rare.
You usually see the mismatch of like Nyla and Riho.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Chris would be there. The thing is, Baker has been so dominant as a champion, it has had an effect of when I've forgotten her name. Ronda Rousey was in MMA, where she cleaned out the division and there was nobody there. And it was like, who's gonna come up against her? And it took 2 years.
Yeah.
For somebody to show up and punch her in the face, and that was the end.
I think we're at a point where there is no one on the roster other than Thunder Rosa that would make logical sense to beat Britt Baker, and that's a bad thing.
I would agree. Yeah, because we know what's going to happen, because the story doesn't have any twist to it.
Yeah, it writes itself.
Because if she – it writes itself. The thing is if Rosa doesn't win, that's frustrating.
And who's next?
If the story is we're going to keep Rosa chasing, that has a limited shelf life. You can only do that so often before she loses credibility.
Yeah.
And with the casual fans who aren't invested in
it. So I'm going to make this analogy, and then I'll put the pin in the discussion. And this may upset people as well. That's fine. And I think that the AEW women's division is the wrestling version of DC's movies. They have all this talent, all this capability, and they just can't get it right.
Y'all can't see the look I'm giving him.
But if you could, it would bring the house down.
I mean, yeah.
So let's go.
I think that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that they're loaded with talent, and this is a situation where they haven't booked it right.
Yep.
I don't think it's for lack of talent.
But I also think that the reason they're not booking it right is they're not booking it. They when you only put one women's match on TV and a whole boatload on the shows that nobody watches, you are signaling to the fans, we don't care about it. So that's okay. I'm looking forward to Britt Baker versus Thunder Rosa. I don't know if I'm looking forward to it as much as buying a house, but apparently you bought a house.
No, I haven't.
You haven't. Okay.
So Final Fantasy 14 is a wonderful MMO. It's probably the best going right now. It is a fantastic MMO that has a ton of really great features in it, and really wonderful layers to it that make for really interesting gameplay. The crafting in it, in a video game, crafting is always fun in a video game. Final Fantasy 14 has figured out a way to make it adventurous, and the actual like actions of crafting are like casting a complex spell, and it's really cool. It's a resource management thing. It's really great. They have even the simplest sets of quests have evolved wonderful storylines. The thing that it's also adds that a lot of other things have that are pretty interesting and frustrating in some cases is player housing. In World of Warcraft, this has never been a thing. The closest anybody got was garrisons, which were fine. My wife used them to make a bunch of gold, but it never felt like it was my garrison. It felt like it was my version of the garrison. You know, it never, because you had to put certain things in certain places. 14 has player housing where you can get a house and you can make it whatever you want. And going around the housing districts, you see just these wonderful spouts of creativity where people are using the components that are built into the game to make really cool stuff. You know, you can have a house that is dedicated to Moogles, to Chocobos, to Carbuncle, and have all kinds of lights and stuff. You can have, you know, a wonderful Asian theme house that looks like something out of, you know, feudal Japan. You can have something that's sleek and modern. You can have a weird D&D house or a S&M house where everything is terrifying and metal and you sleep in a coffin, you know, kind of thing. The thing is, getting a house in 14 sucks. It's just terrible. It comes down to a question of server space where they don't have enough space for everything. The way you have to get a house is first of all, somebody had to give up a house because all the houses are taken. And
oh, it's like Manhattan.
Yeah, it's like Manhattan. You have to wait for somebody literally to stop playing for at least 45 days or to voluntarily give up their house, which
wow,
second part really doesn't happen. And then they list the house and you go, you find it. There's a bunch of secondary stuff where people have like put up discords and, you know, everybody communicates about like, here's all the openings. And then the house is listed. And at some point in the next 24 to 48 hours, it will be purchasable. No one knows when that is.
Oh my God.
So what
I mean, this very much sounds like the open house market that I know, but
yeah, yeah. And what you have to do is stand at the placard and click it to click and hope that you're the one who clicks the buy button when the house comes open.
Wow, that seems like ridiculously archaic of a system.
It is. And I'm looking over at my wife's computer right now. And as soon as we're done here, I'm going to join her doing this. She is actively clicking on her screen. And there is 30 people right next wow. to her. And they're all doing the same thing. People will
it's like camp a bunch of seagulls sitting out there going, or, mine.
They'll camp for days. And the, what they've crazy. Done, they, people have done analytics on it. And they figured out that, okay, in this 4 hour period, the majority of houses go. So you need to stand there. You don't want to click before then because it's a waste of your time. They, oh, it won't amazing. It won't be available.
I would and love to hear Elon Musk's take on this since he thinks we're all living a simulation anyway.
Anyway, I have thoughts about that dude. Anyway.
So let me ask you this. I mean, so could you play the whole game without having this house and still have a great experience?
Absolutely. 100%.
So what's the big draw of the house then?
Because you can make whatever you want.
Well, I can do that in The Sims.
You can take all the components. Yeah, but you can then do that here. You can make a house that does stuff. You can garden, which is a way to make money in the game. Make kill mm-hmm. in the game, where you can crossbreed plants over a bunch of time. You can have a stable for your chocobo. Guilds have houses. My current free company has a house, and that's where we gather before we go do raids and stuff.
You know what's funny to me in this whole discussion? It's really cool. Having spent 16 years of my life in micromanagement corporate hell, it's always funny to me that most people say that they want a game as an escape, that they want a game as a way to get away from the realities of life. When I think in reality, they don't. And that people just want to have that micromanagement capability under their control just the way they want to. Because if you look at things like that, or like EVE Online and the complex systems that you can get to in EVE Online, there are so many big games that offer you the opportunity to play them at the surface level and enjoy them, or dive in at the mid-level and enjoy them, or dive in like head first, hitting the bottom of the ocean, bloodying up your head and sharks all around you, deep end of the pool, and enjoy them. And it's amazing to me that people will get into that levels of micromanagement in their game and call it fun. And I, in some ways, I think that's very cool. And in some ways, it also befuddles me.
Well, that's the jam, right? It's
what it's the love what you love moment, right?
Yeah, the love what you love.
You want to have a house and go farming? Have a house and go farming. Yeah. You don't.
Well, like you played Animal Farm to the point where you built an entire wrestling ring.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's that, but you're in
are you MMO. Talking about my attic with a colored locker to match every colored luchador mask and the
Yeah, it's Animal Farm. It's
Animal Crossing.
Animal Farm. Animal Crossing. Also, Animal Crossing, the best timed release in the history of video games.
And it was quintessentially also the best timed release, similar to how Tiger King was the best timed release on Netflix. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I think had either of those things come out 2 months earlier, would not have been as popular.
I agree.
I think Animal Crossing still would have been as popular because of what it is. But
I don't think it would have been as popular as what it was.
I don't think the Switch would have sold as many units as it did in 2020 without Animal Crossing coming out the time it came out.
100%. 100%. Yep. The thing about housing in 14, just to get back to the topic, they're changing it in the new expansion that's coming out, where they're going to institute a lottery. Still going to be a housing area where
now it sounds like Gen Con housing.
there's still going to be a thing where you can get the hard way, where you stand around and click all day long. But they're also going to have one where you put your name in for a lottery, you put up the money for the house, and then they pick and determine, are you the lucky winner?
No, thank you. House? I don't want anything to do with that. Don't ever let me into that.
So a lot of this also is designed to go against bots and people who are selling houses for real world money. Because what's happening is you can transfer your ownership to someone. Because like me and my wife can't buy a house together as two characters, but I can buy one and make her part of my ownership of it. And so what people will do is they'll buy the house and then put it up for real world money. And people will pay them. And this is how people's accounts get hacked. And that's
Don't do that.
Don't do it. It's bad. It's like buying gold. It's terrible.
So what you're telling me is that I should enter Final Fantasy 14 with expectations.
Yeah, you should. You should expect to have... It is a single player that has MMO attached to it. It has a developer who is so passionate about it that when he delayed the game for 2 weeks, he got down on the table. He planted his face on the table, started crying. He was so sorry to the fans. He loves his fans. And he loves the game. And it's one of those games where you know that everybody involved loves what they're doing. They love what they're building. And it's great. And it shows. And it's detailed and intense. And 14 has a lot of great things. Housing is one of the most frustrating experiences in a game I've come across. So
I think maybe if their developers are that good at micromanagement, they should maybe book the AEW Women's Division. It's time for the main event. I'm gonna go first because I want you to finish, because I think your topic is really fun. I'm going to be very short and sweet with my topic in the main event. Pat and I record and we have video and we can see each other. And he sees behind me, I have HeroQuest, the updated version of HeroQuest, which is sitting there from Hasbro. And I am both elated for, because it was my game. That was the game that got me into board gaming, past Risk, sorry, and all those things. And I am cautiously excited for it, because there have been some things that have had some issues with the game in this new format, mostly for me around how they pack the minis and some of the minis being bent. And my whole thing is that if I'm paying $150 for something, I shouldn't get bent minis. Like that's Bush League stuff. So my whole discussion is really about what I think has become the new norm, and that is the mass general producers of the world are selling nostalgia back to us. If you go back to the 80s, as a kid of my age in the 80s, there were all these things that were just the constants of our lives. G.I. Joe, Thundercats, Care Bears, Strawberry Shortcake. Those were the things that were the defining things of that generation in terms of pop culture. And a lot of those things are being resold to us now as well. If you go to the 90s, you had things like Saved by the Bell and Dawson's Creek and things like that, that also have been redone and resold to us into, I mean, there's a whole new Saved by the Bell series, right? And that stuff is constantly rehashed. And there is always this whole argument of all the ideas have been taken and there's no way to come up with something new. And I don't agree with that. I think there is always opportunities to come up with something new and something creative on stuff. But I think that the board game world, and I'm just going to pinpoint this into the board game world, is running a very big risk of selling nostalgia back to us. Because while I love HeroQuest, and I'm really happy with this copy I have, and I'm looking forward to playing it because it has an app with it and everything like that, I don't think that things like that are going to be as impactful to a new generation of gamers as creatively new games could be for them. And I know this firsthand because as I was trying to explain to my kids who are 16 and 13, I didn't have to explain this to my older daughter at all because she understood it. But as I was trying to explain to my 16 and 13 year old why I was so excited about this game, and then I opened it and they looked at it and they said, so it's minis and it's a dungeon delver and you use cards. What's the big deal? You have seven other games to do that. Like that. And they're not wrong, right? There are many other games. Descent is a great example of, I would consider Descent a modern version of HeroScape. And if you were someone like them who has only played Descent and then they see HeroScape, not as important. And they have to ask that question of, well, why was this the game that got you into it, right? So I think that we run a very, very concerning position of pushing younger gamers away with the idea that these games are the holy grail and these games are the games that everyone should own, when the reality is those things don't maybe stand up through the test of time. And I say that having recently gone back and watched episodes of Mask, episodes of Thundercats, episodes of G.I. Joe, episodes of My Little Pony, episodes of Strawberry Shortcake.
And they're hard watches.
Not a lot that really holds up anymore, right?
The first Transformers movie holds up pretty well, but like, that's about
there
it.
There are some things that are done really well, and I'll give you a great example. I think a good thing that's been done in the recent years that was selling our nostalgia back to us, but done very, very well, was Voltron, the Defender of the Universe that was on Netflix.
Yeah, the new series was really good.
I thought the very small changes that they made that were extremely important to Pidge and Hunk to give them more character definition and make this team a more well-rounded team. And honestly, in my opinion, having a much more intelligent story that was still fun for kids, I thought that was a great change and the attitude that they took on it. But
yeah, I really
then you
it.
Look at other things like some of the Thundercat reboots and you're like, no, they really haven't done very well with those, right?
So
I guess my point is that there's always a chance for nostalgia to be sold to you again, and buyer beware, and make sure that it's not just you throwing money away for the sake of a memory versus you actually getting something that you think is going to be maybe as good or better than what you got originally.
Yeah. And you want to hear something about nested nostalgia. It's terrifying. You think about it. Like, do you get nostalgic for watching A Christmas Story?
Yeah.
I'm going to shoot your eye out.
Yeah.
Thing.
I think I get more nostalgic for the Christmas Vacation than
I do too, because that movie was about the time in my life when I was living through that. The thing about A Christmas Story is that people of our generation and millennials as well, and to a lesser degree Gen Z, are that Christmas Story, as they're older, brings up nostalgic thoughts of their childhood because they watch it with their parents. The thing is, that movie was made to be nostalgic for boomers.
Right.
And now, because they've watched it so much, it is now nostalgic of childhood for the children of boomers.
Right,
and the children of children of boomers. And so it's like nostalgia being sold three times over.
I'm not going to confirm or deny that every November 1st, I change my ringtone on my phone to the theme song for Christmas Vacation, but I'll just leave it at that.
Hallelujah.
All right, so I am
Tylenol.
I am really excited to talk about your topic in the main event tonight, because it has two of my favorite wrestlers on the planet today, and the person that I think inarguably has gotten himself over in the most organic way possible. So fire it up.
All right. So I've had discussions about these two guys with a lot of friends of mine who are wrestling fans. And the opinions about these two guys is very interesting. And I don't know anybody who is lukewarm on either of these cats. And who I'm talking about,
they're polarizing.
They're absolutely polarizing. It's love that, you know, Danhausen and Orange Cassidy.
Love that Danhausen. Very nice.
Love that Danhausen. Very nice. Very evil. And, you know, whatever. I'm good. Like Orange Cassidy takes what Tetsuo Naito did about being, you know, millennial and not caring and, like, turned it up to 11. But he just kind of, like, waved his arm at the knob and it sort of fell. You know, it was a really easable turn.
That's such a good analogy.
Yeah, he really turned it down to negative 11. The thing about Cassidy is that his whole thing was to make the guys in the back laugh. Everything about him was built as a character to make the guys he was working with laugh. And somehow the fans, because they were so smart, and where he was doing it in Gorilla, at Pro Wrestling Gorilla, they caught on and thought it was hilarious. The thing is, and we've seen this in AEW, Orange Cassidy can go. He can absolutely wrestle a full match, but the character that he portrays is so wonderfully not give a damn.
Yep.
And he almost is a postmodern deconstruction of the wrestling character, where he just kind of doesn't care. And the joke becomes all of these guys, and it's this sort of like meta joke where Jim Cornette loses his mind about how these guys wouldn't win in a real fight, and thus they destroy what we talked about earlier, kayfabe, by actually winning, because they do these spots that aren't hurt. Nobody's like Orange Cassidy's signature move is he puts his hands in his pants, shorts, or jeans, and he like taps you on the leg, and it's a kick, and the crowd sells it like he just broke your leg.
The most devastating move in all of professional wrestling.
The surprise roll-up?
No.
you know, he sells it like that. And it's fantastic. The moment, and especially if you're
in a live crowd. And it never gets old.
It never gets old. And he gets guys like Sting to do it with him.
Yep.
And, oh my God, that bit with Sting was funny.
Yeah,
it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in wrestling, because Sting did it with him. And Sting did the, like, he did the gorilla, like, slowly and stuff.
And just for the record, Jim Cornette is a certifiable jackass. That's the end of my discussion on that.
Yeah. The thing about Cornette is he knows a lot about how wrestling was great
in the 70s.
In the 70s and in the 80s. He understands concepts that are really good about, you know, fans and so forth. And getting back to our discussion about the women wrestling, you know, he would have been a Nyla Rose guy.
Yeah.
He's basically, and in a lot of ways, I agree with him. It's very rare that I agree with Cornette in general in terms of philosophy. And I definitely don't on these two cats. These two guys are entertaining as hell. Danhausen, love that Danhausen, is...
You have to take a second and you have to explain Danhausen. Because while you touched Orange Cassidy a little bit, the thing you didn't touch on was that Orange Cassidy had gone through, I think, almost 11 or 12 different concepts for a character.
Yeah.
Before landing on Orange Cassidy. So in a way, his own attitude of I don't give a F is exactly how it came about to be Orange Cassidy.
Yeah. And he kind of came out one night. He was like, fine, this is what I'm going to do. Good luck. See if this gets over. And then it did.
And Danhausen, ironically, I think is very different than Orange Cassidy, but yet extremely similar to Orange Cassidy. And when I said earlier that one of these guys has gotten over in one of the most organic ways possible, it's Danhausen, without a
doubt. Oh, yeah.
Well, Danhausen is probably the most well-known non-AEW star on the AEW roster.
Yeah, he absolutely is. Danhausen is a dude, and we've said his name a bunch of times here. You need to Google him. Danhausen is like the Matrix. You cannot be told about Danhausen. You must experience.
That's Danhausen. A great analogy.
The guy comes out and he's painted like a ghoul. He's got white grease paint on his face, and he's painted to look like a Batman villain almost.
No. He only has red face paint right under his eyes. He'll tell you that directly to your face.
Yeah. Okay. He, like MJF, is almost never out of character. It's extremely rare that he's out of character, and his character is this like meticulous, old school horror character, villainish kind of guy who seems lovable and wonderful, but he's very evil.
Very nice, very evil.
He's the guy that in every episode of Scooby-Doo would say, I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you pesky kids.
Yeah, except like you want him to get away with it. You really do. And he is everything that breaks people's minds about pro wrestling kind of wrapped together. And the way a friend of mine put it, it was like, that is not the voice I expected out of that package.
Right.
Like he talks like this. He's very much he has the villain accent. You know, he speaks in the villain accent. Except he's like this nice, like
he's very nice.
He's very nice, very evil. You know, he's enthralling. I showed him to my wife and she just stared at the screen and was like, "What in the crap is that?" And I was like, It's amazing.
Coincidentally, very much like Orange Cassidy, the guy can go.
Yeah,
he is a wrestler, and he is a good mat wrestler and a good chain wrestler.
Yeah,
and he is a guy that also tried a lot of different gimmicks. In some cases, didn't try enough gimmicks, I don't think, until he finally went into this Danhausen character, and it just took off.
Yeah,
and this is a guy who does toy vlogs. He does. Uh-huh. Unboxings. Everyone on the independents knows him. I mean, if you follow Ethan Page's vlog, you're going to see him on there. If you follow Matt Cardona's vlog, you're going to see him on there. Everybody knows who Danhausen is. And yet, for some reason, he hasn't broken through yet.
And a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was signed with ROH.
Yeah.
And now ROH is dead-ish.
It's paused. Yeah.
It's paused. And, everybody who was on their roster were let out of their contracts if they wanted to be.
Yep.
It's why we have to suffer through Jay Lethal.
There is a big part of me. Well, say what you want about Jay Lethal, the man. And I don't know all the facts of the story with him or anything with what that whole heat, not heat, book, not book kind of thing is.
Mm-hmm.
The match that he put on Dynamite is sick. And I'm just going to leave it at that.
No, I have zero doubt of that. That guy is awesome in the ring.
There is a part of me, and this is the part that lives inside Scott's head that shouldn't really be allowed to speak, and I have to keep pushed down. But there is a part of me, very small part of me, that would love, absolutely love, to see the 24/7 European North Intercontinental Saskatchewan champion, Ron Killings, lose that belt to Danhausen, even if he just gets it back 2 seconds later.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. Absolutely. It'd be, but see, that's the thing, is on the independents and in AEW, Orange Cassidy's a main eventer.
Yeah.
And presented like one. He's presented as a perennial threat. It's absolutely somebody who could take the title. Doesn't need it. Doesn't even come close to needing it.
Not at all.
And would be hilarious. It would be hilarious if you won it, and honestly, to a degree, devalue it because
he
wouldn't care,
right?
And his whole character is about not caring.
Yep.
And
these two guys are very, very different from everything that everybody knows about wrestling. If you are a board game fan, you listen to our podcast, and you don't know a lot about wrestling, I would imagine that if somebody said to you, give me your quintessential stereotypical wrestler, you're probably going to think of somebody like the Ultimate Warrior or Hulk Hogan or Randy Macho Man Savage. You're going to think of a big person, someone that's tall, Andre. Yeah. People who are big guys, muscular guys, constantly working out. Orange Cassidy and Danhausen look like the guys from the swim team in high school. I mean, they are maybe $165, $175 soaking wet with lead weights in their shoes.
Yeah.
They are not. I mean, I would say Cassidy is pretty ripped. Cassidy is actually pretty tight, but he's not like muscular ripped.
He's a lean 6 foot tall.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's not for a wrestler. He's pretty slight.
They are guys that surprise you. And the show that I went to, the AEW show I went to here in Kansas City a couple of weeks ago, Tony Khan reminded the crowd that this was the place where they announced that Orange Cassidy was going to wrestle his first match. And that everyone started chanting, he's going to try. And for the most part, even back then, a lot of people following AEW probably had not seen Orange Cassidy. And then he goes into the match, which what we've talked about on this show, Pac, one of, in my opinion, the two best technical wrestlers on the planet today, him and Bryan Danielson, are the pinnacle. And I would put Kenny Omega up as probably the third one in that rank. He put on a match that was unbelievable. I mean, it's one of the highest watched videos on all of AEW's YouTube page. It's something like 17 million views or something like that. It's just crazy for what it is. And you're right. The guy is always a perennial thorn. But Danhausen, I think, if he's given the stage and given the opportunity, could be just as popular, because the guy, both these guys have a fundamental in-ring capability that you just you can't fake. You can do whatever you want from a character perspective. When the bell rings, you got to go and you got to be an athlete. And these guys are athletes.
Yeah. And the thing is they've figured out how to be this character who is somehow deconstructing everything around them and delegitimizing it, while also at the same time proving they belong by being legitimate. And it's this weird flip that both of them can go, both of them absolutely, but everything about their character is like, no, they don't belong. Get them out of here. Like,
I wonder if you hit on something with that.
In WWE, both of those guys would be 24/7.
And that's it.
Yeah. And that's it. And that would be their ceiling. And Vince would love them as long as they were funny. As long as
and that's not what they are. And no. That's not who they are.
Well, the thing is with Danhausen, he's funny, but he's not a comedy act.
Right.
Like, and he is a guy, he also, one of the things that he did is he took what the Bucks did and what Cody did and what, you know, before them, the Godfather Colt Cabana did, and turned it up to 11. He is self-promoted. Scott talked about it. He is self-promoted on a level that's crazy, to the level that he tweeted our girl Aubrey Edwards about how he was watching this match. In the middle of a live match, he tweets her and is like, "I am watching this on television, and this
Mr. Bowens is cheating.
He is cheating. His partner is beating up Mr. Danielson outside the ring. It is not okay." Then Aubrey answered him.
Yep.
Because Aubrey is game for anything good. And she was like, "What?" At which point he's like, no, you need to keep your phone on you. I will send you messages as I watch it when I see bad things happen.
Yeah. Which, as a wrestling fan, you're like, yeah, that's good. Somebody should tell the referee that's happening. So you get behind him on that, which is so funny.
But also it's like, that is the most silly kind of concept. I wanted during the MJF match for Aubrey to stop to check her phone.
That would have been great.
That would have been
hilarious. Aubrey, if you're listening to this, you got to pull that out at a big moment. That would be phenomenal.
You got to pull that out. And that's how you enter Danhausen, is through Aubrey. You know, like,
that would be pretty funny if her phone keeps going off throughout the match, like constantly. And then he walks out and he's on his phone, like tweeting her. And he's like, look.
Right? Yeah. I have the answer. I've watched
it. That would be pretty funny.
Well, also, you could bring him in because she's, you know, getting heat with the 2.0 and they're calling her out.
Yeah.
And Danhausen gives her the tricks to defeat them. Like, that'd be a fun way to bring him in.
Actually, I think if I were the guy behind all that, I think I might actually book Danhausen to premiere on BTE, not on AEW, and have him become the BTE champion and be like John Silver, become so over that people want and demand that he's on TV. Right?
Yes, I think that'd be fantastic. Because
I think you've hit on something here.
Yeah,
I think. You might have actually stumbled into something that is a good topic for another show. Are they the future of professional wrestling?
I think they are a subset of it. I think guys like, you're always going to have a guy like MJF.
Sure.
Who is just a punchable face. just the most punchable.
I don't like the way you look today.
Yeah, he's like the purest distillation of that I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah.
You're going to have a guy like Darby Allin, who is perpetually the underdog and kind of the outcast guy. You're always going to have the phenom young kid like Jungle Boy and like Sammy Guevara. Gee, I just named the four pillars.
Yeah.
But you're also going to have guys like Kenny and Bryan Danielson and everything. And I think as things become more and more, and BTE prove this, that you can almost completely sell a wrestling show off of a YouTube series.
Yeah.
Namely, All In was essentially the TV for that was all BTE.
Yep. Which, by the way, we didn't talk about this when we did our recap of Full Gear. Mm-hmm. I got the vibe that there was a very, very, very small callback that, if you remember All In, even though we don't like to talk about him, Joey Ball's out and everything, what happened at the end of Hangman's match?
Oh, when the Dark Order went to carry him?
Yeah. Dark Order went to carry him, very much like the penis druids from All In. I think that was very much on purpose. So,
I think that was very much on purpose. I thought it was great.
Here's a good question for you. Who, if we know Cassidy is obviously a star in AEW and is going to continue to be a star and has a lot of opportunity with a lot of feuds. If you were to have full access to book Danhausen in AEW, who would be your like dream match to put him up against?
Against?
Yep.
See, now I'm trying to think of a long-term feud and what it would be. First of all, just like my brain wants to see him versus Eddie Kingston. Because I want to see Eddie's head would explode.
Right. Like it would just, Who are you? What are you doing? Why are you like this?
Because like against Moxley would just stop it. You would just punch him.
Stomp a mud hole in him. Yeah.
Stomp a mud hole in him. Whereas Eddie would like try and talk to him and it would be amazing. And you'd get like what he was doing in Progress where he's basically a pissed off old man. And he like there's a promo if you go find it where he's slapping a guy around and holding him down and like, I'm going to teach you some things, you know? And his whole thing was like, I made all these guys. I'm tired of making stars. And his whole, and him versus Danhausen would be great. I think he has exchanged some stuff with CM Punk. I think that'd be fun.
Oh, he stole his shirt. I mean, he's got a t-shirt that is basically a ripoff of CM Punk's shirt in a very funny and blessed way. Like he gave him the blessing to do that. So I think that one writes itself. You know who I would book him with?
Who?
Adam Cole, baby!
Oh, yeah. That would be another one where Adam sat down. Adam would just stare at him like,
I think with what I've seen between Adam Cole and Budge, I think Adam Cole and Danhausen could just tear the house down.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think it would be a really funny way to bring Danhausen in if he just walked in and acted as though he's the Exalted One. Where everyone's like, why are you here? We don't even know who you are. And he's like, oh, I'm the Exalted One. I'm very nice. I'm very evil. And have them be like, but we don't even know you. You're not like, you don't have a key to the door. You're not allowed in here. Right? Like,
oh, no. I created one.
Hangman let me in.
Yes, it was in the, you left it. Tony left it in the forbidden door.
Yeah, I think that would be so good. And again,
obviously he's going to have some fun with Ethan Page because the two of them are just.
For sure.
Wonderful.
In fact, that could be there's a light bulb that just went off in my head. Follow me down this primrose path, but Ring of Honor doesn't come back. Ring of Honor people have to go find jobs elsewhere. There's talk, you know, people want Danhausen to be signed and everything. What if down the road the Men of the Year become the tag team champions and take it off the Lucha Brothers and end up in a feud with Darby Allin and Danhausen?
They have a match for the remains of Jim Cornette's exploded head.
No, they should have a match for the custody of Sting. No. Or Sting's bat. That's what it should be.
Did you hear the story? Ethan Page has his trunks from when he wrestled Sting. He has those framed.
Nice.
In his house. Nice. Yeah.
Good on him. I like Ethan Page a lot. Julian's a good dude.
He's an exceptional dude. And as somebody put it, best tits in wrestling.
Best smile, for sure.
Oh yeah, no, I have a mild man crush on that guy.
Ethan Page is one of those guys that you can't look in the eyes too long, or you might fall in love.
Yeah, he's a beautiful, beautiful man. But yeah, I think those two guys are a future. They're the future of a portion of professional wrestling.
They're a good example of being able to have a new idea.
Yeah,
because I mean, there's really never been anybody like Orange Cassidy or anybody like Danhausen. And to your point, there's guys that are comedy acts like R-Truth, but they're not original, right? I mean, R-Truth is funny because he's funny. He's not funny because of the character he's playing. Orange Cassidy is funny because of the character he's playing. It's an original thought, and as is Danhausen.
Well, and the thing is, they're self-aware.
extremely self-aware.
That's what makes them so funny, is they invite you to be in the joke with them. And they don't make it an exclusive club. Right. And it takes some walls down, which is great. The other fun, and that's why they're so postmodern and so anti-establishment, is because they're basically staring at the camera going, yes, we know we're ridiculous. Yes. That's the joke. And you're going to love it. Matt Hardy did that with Broken Matt.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the other thing is, and he was right when he said this, it needs a crowd.
Yes. Yeah, if you look at what happened with Broken Matt without a crowd and Broken Matt with a crowd, it was very different.
Broken Matt with a crowd, because then suddenly all that weird stuff gets over, because the crowd is, it's like why you have a laugh track in TV.
Oh, go back to what we talked about with Bryce Remsburg a couple of weeks ago. If you had Invisible Stan versus the Invisible Man with no crowd, it's nothing.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's literally nothing. So
yeah, it's one guy and it's silly and dumb.
So goal for you, dear listeners, your absolute homework, no matter what you take away from tonight's podcast or this afternoon's podcast or this morning's podcast, depending on when you're listening to us, you need to go Google Danhausen. You need to go Google Orange Cassidy, and you can thank us later.
Yes. Love that, Danhausen. Very good. Very evil. He's not good. He's evil.
That's right.
Thank you for listening to us. We love you guys. And
yeah, this was fun again. This was a really good discussion. I think we touched on a lot in this. We touched on, games we like, more terms. I hope our moms are enjoying the terms at least. So I do, you challenged me. You asked me to do stuff for board games. So I think on the next episode, I'm going to introduce some board game terms that we can talk about as well for people who are non-gamers. I believe that everyone's a gamer. I don't believe in the term non-gamer. I think everyone's a gamer and they just don't realize it yet. So we'll talk
about that. Or they don't realize to the degree.
Right, exactly. Everything is a game.
Yeah, everything is.
But we do appreciate you guys listening. Obviously, we'd love to hear from you. Join us online. You can find us on Twitter at Main Event Meeple, and you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Main Event Meeples, because still Tweener is the heel. Our Twitter is the heel, and they won't give us that one extra character, which drives me nuts, but we'll talk about that later. But yeah, thank you so much for listening. Be good, be evil, and do good.
Thank you for wasting your time with us tonight. Have a great night.
This episode was not brought to you in part by the fan who attacked Seth Rollins on Monday Night Raw recently. Don't be that jerk. It's also not brought to you by BoardGameGeek.com's Chocolate Meeples, which, really, come on, those should exist. We really appreciate everybody listening, and we hope that you subscribe to our podcast and look forward to more. You can find us online at Main Event Meeple on Twitter or at Main Event Meeples on Facebook and Instagram. But until we talk next, may all your moments be the main event.